back of the hanging lamp and leads Will toward the tangle of life-size marionettes. They settle down amongst them, weaving their arms and legs around the wires, draping bits of fabric and shredded packing paper over themselves. There's a squeak of a turning knob, and in the doorway stand the silhouettes of two men.
"Get some light in here!" one of them barks.
Will watches as a man wades across the cluttered car and raises the nearest blind. In the pale light, Will recognizes the short, wiry brakeman with pouchy eyes, and now the second man is unmistakable. Brogan. Will's pulse jerks like a restless train. Together, the two brakemen slowly make their way down the center aisle. Clenched in Brogan's fist is a knife. The dying Zouave gives an agonized gasp.
"What the hell's that?"
the pouchy-eyed man hisses.
"A blinking toy," Brogan says, flipping back the sheet with his knife point.
"This place has a bad feel to it," says Chisholm. "My ma says circus folk traffic with the devil."
"Quiet down."
"You ever think the kid just fell off the train?"
Chisholm says.
"We need that key."
"Didn't that guard say there was another one?"
"There is," Brogan says, "but it might be trickier to get. Anyway, we need the boy quiet."
Will feels faint. In a few moments, the two brakemen will come abreast of him and Marin. He makes sure his limbs are loose and his head lolling forward.
"You figure this is real? This mermaid?"
Chisholm asks.
"Dunno."
"Wouldn't mind meeting a real mermaid, not this old rotted one."
From some corner of the carriage comes a scuttling sound.
"Hear that?"
Brogan says. Will does. The erratic gallop of five brawny barbarian fingers. Then silence.
"A mouse, probably,"
says Chisholm.
"Too loud," says Brogan. "Go have a look."
Reluctantly, Chisholm slouches off, muttering,
"Some kind of freaking nature like the rest of the folk here? Two-headed rat or something?"
Brogan stops before the marionettes. With his knife, he pokes distastefully at the closest ones. Will tries not to blink. He doesn't even breathe. His eyes start to water. Why won't Brogan move along?
"I can't find nothing,"
says Chisholm, returning.
"Look at this fella here."
He leans toward the boxer to read the instructions, then stands with a chuckle. He throws a punch at the boxer's head, and the automaton's left hand instantly rises to block it.
"Fuck it!"
says Chisholm, jerking back with surprise.
"That gave me goose flesh!"
"Don't bother with it,"
Brogan says impatiently. But Chisholm is clearly entranced by the boxer. He raises both fists, facing off. He throws a right hook and is blocked, and follows up with a jab with his left. The boxer lowers his glove to deflect the blow.
"How's he do that?"
Chisholm mutters.
"It's just a machine," says Brogan.
"One hell of a smart machine."
Will wishes they'd just move along. Chisholm punches faster and harder, and Will can hear him puffing and grunting as the automaton effortlessly blocks him. Then, from the corner of his eye, Will sees Attila the Hun's hand crouching in the shadow of a crate right near him. There's something expectant in the flex of its fingers. It steps closer. Chisholm backs up, taking a breather. In horror, Will watches as the hand scuttles closer still to him.
"Hear that?" Brogan says. "That same rustling sound."
He steps toward the marionettes. The hand touches Will's shoe tentatively, tapping with its fingertips. Will forces himself to look away. He doesn't want to encourage it. He swallows when he feels a weight on his shoe and knows the hand has climbed on.
"Somewhere around here,"
Brogan's saying, not 5 feet from Will. Will stays very still. The hand moves up to his ankle, and its fingers tighten in a grip so painful he starts to sweat.
"It's a hand," says Brogan, "on that puppet's leg."
"Those dolls give me the creeps,"
says Chisholm, looking directly at Will, who tries to make his eyes glassy.
"There's something not right about that one."
Leaning forward for a better look, the brakeman puts his hand on the boxer's shoulder. The boxer's left arm delivers an undercut that snaps Chisholm's haggard head back. He hits the floor like a bag of flour.
"Bloody idiot,"
says Brogan, turning. He kneels and slaps Chisholm's face.
"What? What?"
the brakeman moans. The severed hand hops onto Will's knee, and his leg involuntarily jerks. Brogan looks over, and then up to the sound of running on the roof. There seems to be shouting, but Will can't make out the words. A second set of swift footsteps is followed by a third. Will can't see it, but he hears the rear door of the carriage suddenly open, and someone wailing.
They got a feckin' Sasquatch!
From the doorway comes a blood-freezing animal wail, and Will sees Brogan's body tense.
Dear Mother,
Chisholm squeaks, scrambling to his feet. Will senses a large presence enter the car, and at the same moment, the smell reaches him. That strange, curdled smell that no other creature in the world has.
Don't run, calls a voice from the rear of the carriage. You make him charge!
Nonetheless, Brogan and Chisholm take a few steps back as the Sasquatch looms into view, restrained by three trainers holding chains. Goliath is 6 feet tall, and though his body is lean, it seems like it can barely contain the power and fury beneath the skin. The Sasquatch stops and stares long and hard at Brogan, exhaling through his nostrils in hoarse, angry bursts.
Easy, Goliath,
says one of the trainers, whom Will recognizes as Christian. Without warning, Goliath lunges, his chest and muscle-knotted arms straining. The trainers lean back with their full weight. Will can almost feel the heat pouring off the Sasquatch.
Get that thing away from me,
bellows Brogan, his face gray with terror.
I'd drop that knife if I were you,
says Christian. Will watches as Brogan lets it clatter to the floor.
Goliath seems to know you,
Mr. Dorian remarks, stepping out from behind the trainers. Will remembers how, in the mountains, Brogan stabbed the young Sasquatch in the shoulder. Clearly, Goliath has not forgotten.
Perhaps I didn't make myself clear the first time we met,
Mr. Dorian says, and suddenly his polite calm disappears, and Will jerks in surprise at the ringmaster's rage.
You and your men are not welcome aboard my train, sir. The boy you are looking for is not on these carriages.
Goliath gives an unearthly wail as if to emphasize the words.
Let this be your last trespass, Mr. Dorian seethes. If I see you or any of your men aboard my train again, I will loose Goliath on you, and my enjoyment will match his as he rips your limbs from your body. Do I make myself clear, Mr. Brogan?
Name's Brinley,
the brakeman mutters.
Is it?
Says Mr. Dorian.
I bid you good day, sir.
Now get out!
Brogan and Chisholm beat their retreat to the far end of the car. Will waits for the sound of the closing door. After a moment, Mr. Dorian looks directly at Will and says,
You can come out now.
Marin reaches over and flicks a little switch on the back of Attila the Hun's hand. Its grip relaxes instantly, and it falls off Will's leg. He stands uncertainly, keeping his eye on the Sasquatch.
You all right, sis?
Christian asks Marin.
Of course,
she replies.
I'd give you a hug, but Goliath might get jealous.
Thanks for saving the day.
You can take Goliath back to his cage now,
Mr. Dorian tells the trainers.
This way, Goliath,
Christian says with a tug on the chain. Will feels a pang of sympathy for the Sasquatch. It was born in the mountain wilds, and is now forced to live in prison-like confinement, with none of its own kind for company. It shrugs against the pull of the chains, and turns to stare right at Will with its fathomless eyes. Will stands very still.
He remembers you too, says Mr. Dorian.
In a good way, I hope,
Will murmurs. After what seems like a long time, Goliath snorts and follows his trainers out of the car. Mr. Dorian's expression is so severe that Will worries the ringmaster might be angry with him.
I'm sorry for all the trouble,
Will begins.
Don't be absurd, says Mr. Dorian. None of this is your fault.
How many were there?
Marin asks.
9 this time. It was all I could do to keep our people from fighting.
The ringmaster looks thoughtful.
9 men. It must be quite an undertaking, Mr. Brogan's planning.
Maybe he's ready to give up searching,
Marin says hopefully. Will swallows.
He knows there's another key.
Your father's,
says Mr. Dorian.
We have to warn him.
They're planning something big, and if Brogan's willing to kill a guard...
Your father's no man to be trifled with, Mr. Dorian says calmly. I very much doubt our Mr. Brogan would risk such a confrontation. If your father's in the locomotive, he's got people around him all the time. Brogan wouldn't attempt it.
Will wishes he were more reassured.
As it is, we're leaving in a matter of hours, Mr. Dorian says, clapping him on the shoulder. But first, we have to finish your disguise. Madame Lemoine is ready for you.
Stroke after stroke. The paint goes on, thick and greasy. Will doesn't like the feel of it on his skin.
It dries,
says Madame Lemoine ambiguously. She's done with his face and neck, and is now finishing off his hands. Marin returns with some clothing draped over her arm.
We have an Indian fortune-teller costume that might fit, she tells Mr. Dorian, who's overseeing Will's transformation.
There is a loose-fitting white shirt with beadwork around the collar and buttons, a pair of white cotton trousers, and a brown leather vest.
Stand,
says Mrs. Lemoine, and stands back to look at him. She slaps him here and there, moving him around so she can examine him from every angle.
Don't touch your face, is all she says.
He thinks he understands what she means about it drying. The paint doesn't feel quite so wet and heavy.
Try them on,
Marin says, holding out the clothes. Will takes them behind a faded Japanese screen. He's worried about where he'll put his things, especially the key, but he's relieved to find that the inside of the vest has many ingenious pockets sewn into it. He transfers his items and takes off his borrowed clothes. He's glad to be rid of them. These new ones fit much better. When he steps out, Marin gives a melodramatic gasp.
What have you done with William Everett? She demands.
Mr. Dorian nods his approval.
This will do nicely.
Will goes to the mirror and stares. He feels like he's inside a complete stranger, peeping out through their eye holes.
I don't recognize myself at all.
Excellent to hear, says Mr. Dorian.
Will looks older, and somehow fiercer. His teeth are startlingly white, his eyes piercing in his pale brown face. A sense of liberation floats up within him. He's just performed his own personal disappearing act. Chapter 9. The Players. They don't look like circus performers as they step off the train in Kirkton. No clown makeup, no sparkly clothes. Will thinks they must look as solemn as a funeral party. There is Mr. Dorian, a sleek raven in his suit and top hat and silver-tipped cane. Marin's braids are tucked modestly inside the collar of a navy blue greatcoat that goes to her ankles, and Will himself wears a dark wool jacket over his shirt and trousers, and a cap atop his black head of hair. Only Mr. Beaupré stands out, on account of his awesome size. Even though he won't be performing with them on the Boundless, the giant insisted on walking them up to the colonist class, and carrying their bags. Will wonders if he's secretly hoping for the chance to throw someone. If he is, it looks like he'll be disappointed. As they tramp along the gravel, Will spots several brakemen smoking atop boxcars or inspecting the couplings, but they keep their distance. The afternoon air carries the cold promise of snow. The farther north now, and the trees are spindlier. The ground is rocky and grudging. There's no sign of a town in the distance, or the noise of a trackside market. Will figures the stop is too short, or there just aren't enough people in Kirkton. With Marin at his side, Will walks after Mr. Dorian, trying not to appear too hasty. One car after another, they make their way forward. Even with Mr. Beaupré nearby, Will worries they'll be confronted by Brogan and his cohort any second. It seems incredible to him he hasn't been recognized. His face is the same shape, his eyes the same color, but he supposes people never look that closely at things. As Mr. Dorian might say, we're easily fooled by our eyes. Still, Will is pretty sure some of the brakemen are staring hard at him as he passes. Maybe they're just curious about all the circus performers. The brakemen can't all be working for Brogan, but judging by the crew that broke into the circus cars, there are plenty. And how can Will tell the honest from the wicked? His disguise isn't the only thing he's worried about. He has to remember not to speak when they're around other people, which will be pretty much all the time. He's quiet by nature, so maybe it will be easier than he thinks, but he's not so shy around Marin, which is one of the reasons he likes her so much. As they make their way, Mr. Beaupré cheerfully bellows out the names of all the different types of trees, and the birds flitting between their branches. From the roof of a livestock car, a brakeman wolf whistles at Marin.
"Come whistle for me, you brazen fiend!"
Mr. Beaupré roars up at him. The brakeman cringes and slinks away. Marin doesn't seem at all bothered. Will realizes she must be used to this kind of attention. For the first time, he understands what a rough world this must be for a girl. Without her parents, too. At least she has her brothers, but they won't be with her for the next few days. Just Mr. Dorian. And him. But it seems little protection against the rough men along the steel road. He glances over at her. He has no doubt she's good at taking care of herself, but the thought comes into his head suddenly. I would like to protect her. He almost laughs at himself. Isn't she the one protecting him? He wishes he could talk to her. There are still a lot of things he wants to tell her and ask her. 3 years' worth of questions. He contents himself with studying her profile. She has a very interesting nose. They round a bend in the track, and up ahead, Will sees a huge crowd. There are no vendors or stalls, just colonists stretching their legs and taking the air alongside the train. From the rear of the last colonist car, a handsome young porter appears on the steps. Will feels a surge of relief at the sight of him, looking crisp and official in his boundless uniform.
"Would you be Mr. Dorian?" he asks the ringmaster.
"I would."
"My name's Thomas Drury. We're expecting you, if I might just see your passport, sir."
"Of course."
Mr. Dorian produces a paper booklet and hands it to Drury. The porter glances up at Marin and Will.
"And what are your names, please?"
"Marin Amberson."
Drury looks at Will with some suspicion.
"And you?"
Mr. Dorian says.
"That is Amit Sen, our spirit artist. He understands a little English, but speaks none."
"What does he speak?"
"Hindi," says the ringmaster.
"Me mafi makta ho dekin me ne hi angrati bakkoti,"
says Will politely, just as he was coached by one of the performers an hour before. Drury's eyes widen.
"What did he just say?"
"He apologized for not speaking English," says Mr. Dorian.
"And the large gentleman?"
Drury asks with some concern.
"Mr. Eugene Beaupré. He won't be accompanying us."
"Excellent. Please, come aboard."
"Thank you, Mr. Beaupré,"
Marin says, and gives the giant a hug around his trunk-like waist.
"I will see you in Lionsgate City, little wonder,"
he replies fondly. He gives one last fierce look around, as if daring anyone to bother her, then starts back to the Zirkus Dante cars, whistling. Will boards. He remembers being squished into third class when he was younger, but he's never seen anything quite like this. At first, he thinks it must be the baggage car, for there are so many things everywhere. Suitcases and sacks and oddly shaped bundles trussed up with twine. But amongst it all, there are people. Far too many to count. Even though many passengers are still outside, the place feels impossibly full. The smell barrages Will. Sausage and unlaundered clothes, and the reek of an overused toilet. Pickles, sweat, wet boots, and incense all add to the din of smell. On either side of a narrow aisle are rows of bare wooden benches. An old man bounces a crying baby on his knee, singing a nursery rhyme in another language. 4 men have their heads bowed over a game of cards. An anxious woman counts rosary beads. Between 2 fellows is spread a map, and they are stabbing their fingers at it and arguing. And above these wooden benches are 2 levels of pull-down berths. On one, a mother and baby sleep curled up together. On another, a burly man picks at his big toe. 2 boys leap between berths while a mother hollers at them from the floor. Threadbare blankets and lumpy makeshift pillows are scattered everywhere. There is scarcely room to move. More children bound down and up the aisle and clamber over the backs of the bench seats, making a playground of the carriage. The only light comes from narrow windows, high up near the ceiling, and a few oil lamps secured to the walls. Slowly at first, and then more quickly, people start to notice Will and the others.
Circus.
Zirkus.
Zirkusen.
Zirkusi.
The word whispers and slithers itself through the car in all different languages. Most of the people look glad. A few shrink back as the trio passes. A small girl cries at the sight of Mr. Dorian, in his severe black top hat and coat, until the ringmaster pulls a lollipop from his pocket and hands it to her. Suddenly, the performers have a trail of children, their hands tugging, eyes imploring. More lollipops and jawbreakers appear from the ringmaster's bottomless pockets. Applause and cheers ring out from the passengers.
"You'll need to clear this aisle,"
Drury calls out pointlessly, for no one heeds him.
"You can't have all this here. It must be cleared of obstructions. Is that a chicken?"
A stove blazes in the center of the car. No fewer than 7 pots sputter atop it. Will supposes this is how they eat. You cook when the stove's free and take your meals whenever you can.
"Is there just the one stove?"
Merrin asks Drury. He looks at her with a confused smile and ignores her question, as if it isn't even worth consideration.
"I'm sorry you have to pass through all this," Drury says to Mr. Dorian. "It's rather ripe in here."
"Not surprising," Mr. Dorian remarks tartly, "as it seems they have only one washroom per car."
As Will makes his way, he realizes these people have less room to themselves than the Circus Dante animals. It can't be right to have such cramped quarters when there is such luxury farther up the train. Does his father know how terrible it is back here?
"These people are fortunate to get passage on the Boundless at all," Drury says with a sniff. "They're the poorest of the poor, and they've washed up on the shores of our country to claim our land."
"Interesting," says Mr. Dorian. "My mother's people are Cree Indian. Perhaps it's people like you who have washed up on our shores." "A stimulating thought, don't you think?"
Drury clears his throat and keeps walking.
"There's rumors we may have a murderer aboard," he says. "And I'd bet anything it's one of these folks. I'd keep your eyes peeled."
Mr. Dorian lifts his hat to a large woman in a colorful headdress.
"Good day, ma'am. Now, Drury, if you could show us to where we'll be performing."
"We've made a space for you a few cars up," he says. "I hope it's adequate."
"I'm sure it's more than adequate," says Mr. Dorian.
They cross several more carriages before they reach a car with an entire section that's been curtained off at the back. Will expects this must be the stage, but when Drury parts the curtains, Will sees what appears to be a small shop with many shelves, loaves of pumpernickel bread, cooked hams, tins of vegetables, some fresh fruit, bars of soap, towels, various corked bottles of different shapes and colors. A finely turned out gentleman sitting on a cushioned bench looks up as they enter.
"Ah, you must be the entertainment for the day,"
he says in what sounds to Will like an upper-crust English accent.
"I'm Mr. Peters."
Right away, Will notices how amazingly clean his fingernails are, and not only clean, but buffed and shaped in a perfect curve.
"You're the chief porter?" Mr. Dorian inquires.
"No, no, just a paying passenger. Isn't that right, Drury?"
Yes, Mr. Peters, sir," says Drury.
He certainly does not look like the other passengers. He has an entire corner of the carriage, the equivalent of 3 rows of seats, curtained off with thick drapery. At each entrance, front and back, sits a bearded man in a bulky coat, a rifle tilted against his seat.
"You're a merchant, too, by the looks of it," says Mr. Dorian, surveying his goods.
"Well, as you know, the Boundless doesn't provide a meal service to these poor people, so I do my bit," says Peters.
$2 for a loaf of bread," says Marin, reading the sign.
"Yes, miss."
"It seems a lot for a loaf of bread," she remarks.
"That's the fair market price aboard the Boundless, young miss. And before you get all holy on me, how many people of my sort do you think would choose to ride with this class of people? I do it so I can help them.
Ah, says Mr. Dorian.
That is very noble of you.
We're just in the next car, says Drury, eager to lead them on.
It's disgusting,
mutters Merrin when they've left.
Is the conductor aware there is a profiteer aboard the train?
Mr. Dorian asks Drury, who looks distinctly uncomfortable.
He's paid for all those seats fair and square, says Drury. The passengers are happy enough to have him aboard when they need something.
To Will it sounds like a speech he's made before. He wonders again if his father knows this is going on aboard the Boundless.
We've had the passengers clear an area here, Drury says curtly,
leading them into the middle of the car.
Will can just imagine how the likes of Drury would go about getting people to leave their seats, but he's surprised to be greeted only by grins, excited smiles, and more applause by all the people they've displaced.
Thank you, thank you, says Mr. Dorian graciously.
Vielen Dank, merci, grazie. We promise you a good show, and you shall have the best seats in the house. We begin in 1 hour.
Sheets have been pegged up to form a curtain and backstage area around the several vacated rows of seats. Drury bids them good day and exits through the door at the front of the carriage. Will's eyes linger on that door. Beyond it, there is another colonist car, and hundreds more leading to third class, then second class, and finally first. The journey is right there, ready for him to take.
The pair of them are disgusting, says Merrin, setting down her bag behind the curtains. Peters and that cowardly porter. It shouldn't be allowed.
It has always been thus, says Mr. Dorian. I don't see it changing.
All around them is the din of the passengers, so Will feels he can speak in a whisper without danger.
I'm going to tell my father. He's a fair man. He won't stand for it.
Mr. Dorian smiles faintly.
You of all people should know how the railway was made, William. On the backs of poorly paid laborers. $1 a day to risk your life. Less if you weren't a white man.
Well, says Will stubbornly, my father was one of those laborers. You wouldn't want to see them badly treated on his own train.
Mentioning his father makes Will all the more impatient.
I've been thinking. I can find my way from here.
Merrin looks at him in surprise.
What do you mean?
You don't need me. I can make my way up front.
But that's not the plan.
Mr. Dorian regards him calmly.
I wouldn't advise it, William. You have no ticket, no passport to get between cars. They won't let you through. Even if they did, you can be sure Brogan's men are watching, and it seems to me he's been talking this up with Drury and maybe other porters too. They're on the lookout for a murderer, and they'll report anything suspicious back to Brogan. You're safest to wait with us until we reach first class.
It's only 2 more nights, Will,
Merrin reminds him. She seems genuinely concerned.
You're safest with us.
Chewing his lip, Will looks again at the door. What if Brogan tries to steal the key from his father and there's a fight? His father is strong, but how good is he with his fists or against a knife? In his stories, he mentioned breaking up plenty of fights. If he could survive 3 years working the rails, he can handle the likes of Brogan.
All right, he says, dragging his eyes away from the door.
He's still worried about his father, and he's also terrified of performing. Never in his life has he done something like this. In school, when he had to speak before the class, he dreaded it for days beforehand. And on the day itself, he felt such intense horror walking up before the other students that he thought he might pass out. Every useful thought and word flew from his head.
It'll be fine,
Merrin whispers, as though reading his mind.
You're not Will Everett anymore. You're someone completely different. That's the wonderful thing about performing. It's not even you up there. It's someone who has amazing skills and power you never dreamed you could have.
For a flash, he feels it again. The freedom of inhabiting another body that isn't quite his own.
You're going to love it,
Merrin tells him. Brogan strides with ease across the tops of the cars, heading forward. This is his terrain, this constantly moving, jostling road. and he knows its every landmark. He's as sure-footed as a mountain goat, despite a limp. The limp's not from blasting or laying steel. Years he spent working the railway. Men died around him all the time, especially the Chinamen. But he was charmed. He was the best blaster around, and he wasn't injured until the very last day when the Sasquatch grabbed his leg and hurled him into the gorge. He should have been killed, but there was a bit of scrub on the cliff face, and he grabbed hold and stayed put, invisible until the coast was clear. Then he climbed back and limped his way over the mountain to make a new identity for himself. A new name was all it took. Brogan doesn't know if the Everett boy is on or off the train. Maybe the kid did fall off that night. All Brogan knows is there's no way he's going back into those Zirkus cars with that Sasquatch around. There's not much he's afraid of, but those beasts turn his insides to liquid. It doesn't matter, though. There's another key. The drunken fool of a guard told him so. Brogan reaches the front of first class and drops down onto the platform. Brakemen aren't supposed to enter first-class cars. He stands out. He's not dressed pretty, but he'll be quick. He steps into the elegant carriage and sticks his head into the steward's office. Empty. On the wall is a board of stateroom keys, all neatly labeled for the trip. He sees the one marked Everett and takes it. The stateroom is the first one down. He's inside in 2 seconds. He listens, but there's no one moving about upstairs. He moves to the roll-top desk and starts pulling open drawers, sifting through papers. Nothing. Checking every surface, every shelf and cubbyhole, he moves through the parlor and then upstairs. The main bedroom looks as though it hasn't been slept in. He checks through the chest of drawers without any luck. Then the boys' room. Same. He's in a rage, wanting to slam and break the room apart. He takes a moment to calm his breathing. The only other key must be on James Everett's body. He leaves the room as he found it, exits the car, and climbs to the roof. It will be bloodier, but there's no going back now. His new plan assembles itself with each step of his long journey back. Will peeks through the gap in the curtains. The Boundless is moving again. And, with all the passengers back aboard, the car seems impossibly full. On either side of the makeshift stage, people are sitting on the floor, in one another's laps, perching on one another's shoulders, dangling off the dangerously sagging berths. On stage, Mr. Dorian has just mesmerized a fellow who chirps like a bird. The crowd laughs uproariously. Will lets the curtain fall into place and swallows.
"You all right?"
Marin whispers to him. He nods. He doesn't want to talk. 4 portraits. That's all he has to draw, but he feels like he might throw up. In his pocket, his hand finds the Sasquatch tooth, and he rubs its pitted surface.
"I'll be with you the whole time,"
she says, and gives his hand a squeeze. For a moment, he's distracted by the touch of her skin against his, but then Mr. Dorian's voice rings out his cue.
"And now, ladies and gentlemen, you're about to witness a most curious thing. Throughout history, there have been gifted artists who can draw a portrait, but could any of them draw a portrait without setting eyes on their subject? The young man you are about to meet was born in the Kingdom of India, and studied many years to hone his gift. 4 lucky people in this audience will be chosen to have their portraits drawn. I introduce to you Amit, the spirit artist."
Will doesn't hear most of this. It's just a rattle of words in his head. Marin's gentle nudge tells him he's on. He swallows and walks out. Mercifully, he has only a brief moment to see the audience, a solid mass of bodies and heads in expectant heat. He's glad when Marin leads him to the stool and he sits facing the wall.
"Who will be the first to be drawn?"
Mr. Dorian asks.
A veritable roar consumes the carriage. "You, sir, come forward, please. Stand here. That's it, directly behind him. Now behold, to make sure he cannot see a thing."
On cue, Marin holds the scarf in front of the audience. She walks behind Will to tie it around the face of the volunteer.
"Can you see anything, sir?"
Mr. Dorian asks.
"Nyet, nothing." "Bind our spirit artist, then," says Mr. Dorian, "and let him begin."
The scarf is wound around Will's head. He can see through it perfectly. He reaches out blindly with his hands, and Marin gives him his sketchbook and pencil. Then she takes a few paces back and stands in front of him. He focuses on the ingenious mirrored sequins on Marin's dress. Together, they form a kind of mosaic. It's not a perfect image by any means, but it's enough. Will and Marin agreed on a system beforehand. He scratches his ear, she turns to the right. He taps his foot, she turns to the left. He sees the face of the man, a rectangle of solid flesh and bone, a single heavy eyebrow. Will is nervous and worries they'll see his hand shaking, but he remembers his childhood trick. His eye is the pencil. And so he starts, traveling this little landscape of wrinkles and curves, shading here and there. He works quickly, knowing he cannot let the audience wait too long. It is not good work, but after 1 minute, Mr. Dorian whisks the portrait away and holds it before the audience.
"Is not the likeness amazing?" he cries.
There is a healthy murmur of approval, then clapping, and then a crush of people pushing forward to be next. Will does another, more confidently now. In the reflection of Marin's sequins, he glimpses the look of delight when the woman is given her sketch. She shows it to her husband and children. She does not even want to fold it. He wonders if she's ever had her photograph taken. Two more, and then quite suddenly, he is done, taking his bow, buffeted by applause. When he and Marin step back behind the curtain, he feels ignited, unable to stand still. Marin laughs.
"That wasn't so bad, was it? I liked it."
It's so noisy all around them, he has no fear of being overheard.
"Told you. You'll join the circus yet."
"Do you get nervous anymore?"
he asks.
"Sometimes."
When Marin is called out to do her act, Will watches intently through a gap in the curtain. She is calm and poised. In her hand she holds a compact spool like something you'd see on a fishing rod. As she turns the small handle, wire begins to pay out rigidly in a horizontal line. At its end is a small grappling hook. Round and round she turns the wheel, and the line stretches out. The audience shuffles out of the way as it passes them. Will has never seen such a device, a little magic trick in itself. When the line reaches all the way across the carriage, Marin gives a little twist of her wrist, and the hooked end grips a ledge about 3 feet up the wall. Marin then runs to the opposite end of the carriage, paying out more line, and hooks the spool to the wall there. She has created her own tightrope down the middle of the car. She springs onto it, her head nearly grazing the ceiling. The crowd gives a great cheer. Once on the wire, Marin is like a person transformed. He suddenly doesn't know her at all. He can only stare in amazement as she skips across the wire, does somersaults, closes her eyes and walks backward, lies down on her stomach and pretends to fall asleep. Despite all the good cheer of the crowd, Will notices how some of the men look at her, a furtive, hungry look he doesn't like. Marin invites people to toss things up at her, and she catches them one after another, a hat, a bottle, a sausage, and proceeds to juggle them all. After throwing the objects back to their rightful owners, she hops down, unhooks her tightrope, and cartwheels down the aisle to the stage. It's time for the disappearing act. Will watches as chains are placed upon her by an audience member, and she is covered by a giant scarf. He stares hard, wanting to understand the trick, and nearly jumps out of his skin when she taps him on the shoulder behind the curtain.
"How do you do that?"
he demands.
"I'll never tell,"
she replies, rosy-cheeked and breathless. He wishes he could draw her just like that. Mr. Dorian pulls back the curtain to reveal all of them, and there is a tsunami of applause. Even those lucky men and women who had seats are now on their feet, clapping and shouting, "Bravo!" and "Brava!" and other words Will doesn't understand. A dizzying happiness blossoms inside him. The audience surges toward them, and Will is worried they'll be crushed. They're all three taken hold of and hoisted up onto shoulders and carried out of the car into another, where there is a stove covered with pots. Bundles are moved, people shift, and Will finds himself eased onto a bench beside Marin. She looks as bewildered as he feels. Scarcely has he been seated when a bowl of food is put on his lap and a spoon into his hand, and Will understands they have been invited to dinner. The food smells delicious, but he's hardly taken a mouthful before people are touching him and asking him questions in different languages. He knows he mustn't reply in English, so he only smiles and nods and sometimes repeats the few Hindi words he's memorized. Across the sea of heaving bodies, he sees someone who looks Indian trying to reach him. What if the man wants to talk to Will? He'll be found out. Luckily, musical instruments suddenly appear. Strange, stringed things, mouth harps, a contraption that looks a bit like an accordion. The colonists are putting on their own show now, maybe as a way of thanking the performers. Will feels a bit smushed and deafened, but it is all so good-natured that he doesn't mind too much. A drink is thrust into his hand, and the man looks at him so expectantly that Will doesn't see he has any choice but to slug it back. It sears all the way down his throat. The crowd gives a cheer. By the time the dancing starts, Will has had two more of the drinks and thinks dancing is probably the best thing in the world. He enters a sweaty web of arms and stamps about the floor, having no idea what he's doing. Nearby, he sees Marin being whirled about, a dazzling, colorful blur. He wants to grab hold of her, to stop her moving, to feel her skin against his hands. And suddenly, they are pressed together, and the crowd is close around them and clapping hands eagerly.
"They want us to dance," Marin says.
He almost replies in English, tells her he can't dance, but it's too late. She's taken his hands and starts leading him in a mangled version of the waltz. After a few steps, he tries to lead and stamps on her feet, and then she leads again, and before long they're both laughing helplessly. A woman's cry of dismay suddenly cuts through the music. The instruments stop. There's a flurry of harsh words. The crowd shifts, angling itself in the direction of the noise. Will looks over to see one of Mr. Peters's burly guards. He towers over a shorter man, whose face is flushed and furrowed with outrage. A woman, maybe his wife, is shouting at the guard, while a small boy watches, clinging to her side, his face pale with fear. The guard shoves the other man against the wall, reaches inside his jacket, and pulls out a slender bottle. The man tries to grab it back, but the guard strikes him across the face. For a moment, everyone in the car is silent. Then several other colonists shout out and move aggressively toward the guard, but Peters's man primes his rifle, and the passengers halt and step out of his way.
"Is there a problem?" Mr. Dorian asks the guard as he passes.
"Nothing to do with you,"
grunts the man, and leaves the carriage. The woman is crying openly now.
"Their boy is sick," a man says to Dorian. "Mr. Peters sells medicine. The father of boy has not money to pay. Mr. Peters gives medicine but wants money later. The father tries to sell something to make money, but it's no good. Now Peters takes back medicine."
"He has no money at all?" Mr. Dorian asks.
"Only food for trip, but Mr. Peters doesn't want food. He wants deed."
Marin frowns.
"Deed?
Land deed. What family comes for."
"Ah," says Mr. Dorian. "His government land grant."
Will knows about these. Most of the colonists are on their way to claim their land and start farms and ranches. The deed is their proof of ownership. Without it, they would have nothing.
"It seems our Mr. Peters is also a land speculator," Mr. Dorian says.
Will is looking at the little boy, his pinched face. He's never felt such a hot rush of indignation. Without thinking, he marches after Peters's guard. Marin is close on his heels.
"Amit," she whispers. "What are you doing?"
He ignores her, keeps going, all the way to Peters's car. He's aware of Marin at his side, and Mr. Dorian not far behind. She hisses into his ear,
"Don't do anything stupid."
Will has no tricks, no power, but he does have almost $3 in his pocket. He bursts into the curtained room to find Mr. Peters eating from a fine plate and drinking a glass of wine. The guards both stand at his sudden entrance.
"Ah, the circus boy," he says. "I'm sorry I missed your show. I've never been one for tawdry entertainments."
From his pocket, Will takes the coins and places them before Mr. Peters.
"Medicine,"
he says.
"Ah, so you do speak a little English?"
Will says nothing, knowing he's made a mistake, but surely Ahmet would have picked up a few English words quickly.
"He wants the medicine for that boy,"
Marin says beside him. Mr. Peters' eyes will with amusement and curiosity.
"I'm glad to see your ringmaster pays you so handsomely. I've heard some can be terrible slave drivers. I shall happily sell you the medicine."
He nods at his guard, who takes the little bottle from the shelf and tosses it to Will. Will catches and pockets it.
"Not only rich, but a good Samaritan," says Mr. Peters.
"It's heartwarming."
"We're quite the same. It was lucky I had the right medicine for that boy. If the conductor were to hear there was a sick family aboard, he might turn them off the train, where their situation would be altogether more desperate. It's better this way, handled by compassionate fellows like us."
Will knows this is some kind of threat. "Keep quiet about this, about what I do here, or the family will suffer." Will turns to Marin, pretending he hasn't understood a word, and sees Marin's face pale with rage. This time, it's he who puts a hand on her arm, afraid she'll do something rash.
"Don't forget your change," Mr. Peters says.
Will turns back and takes the coins offered him. Mr. Dorian is watching from the curtain silently, and actually tips his hat to Mr. Peters before turning to leave. Will makes his way through the cars to the boy's family and holds out the medicine bottle to the mother. Her eyes widen with surprise.
"That man, he will not come to take it back?"
the father asks nervously.
"No,"
says Marin. The boy looks at the bottle and bursts into tears.
"Why is he crying?"
Marin asks.
"The taste,"
says his mother.
"He doesn't like it."
The boy sobs something that sounds like boat.
"What's he saying?"
Marin asks.
"There is a toy, a boat, we leave behind,"
the mother says.
"And he is sad about this still."
Into Marin's ear, Will whispers,
"Ask her what it looks like."
Marin asks, and Will waits as the mother translates the question for her son. The boy smiles, and his pale face becomes animated. He prattles for a long time, as the mother tells Marin the details. Will pulls out his sketchbook and starts to draw, rapidly, but with as much detail as possible. He tears the page from the book and hands it to the boy. The boy frowns and points to the smokestack. The mother says something sharply to the boy, and his eyes fill with tears again.
"What's wrong?"
Marin asks.
"He is greedy,"
the mother replies. Will looks at the boy and sees him trace an outline of a bigger smokestack on the picture. Will reaches over, and with a quick flourish of his pencil, enlarges the smokestack and adds a healthy puff of smoke. The boy beams at Will, and he feels like a hero.
"I hope your boy gets better soon,"
says Marin.
"Thank you,"
the father says to them.
"Thank you."
"Circus.
Zirkus.
Zirkusen. Zirkusi."
The word that marked Will's entrance marks his exit, with cheers and clapping as surly Drury leads them through the last of the colonist cars. Hefting his small suitcase, Will feels suddenly exhausted. He's never wanted bed so badly. Drury brings them to a reinforced door that requires two keys to unlock. When he swings it open, the noise of the tracks pours in. Cold air smacks Will in the face. It's very dark outside now. Across the couplings, a second porter stands behind the lighted window of the other car. He nods at Drury and opens his door, and Will moves his leaden body after Mr. Dorian and Marin across the shuddering platform to third class. Chapter 10. Muskeg.
"Mind your step, please," says the porter as he ushers them inside. He's a gangly fellow whose narrow wrists shoot past his cuffs. "The mail car's a bit cluttered. We don't get many people coming through here."
Will steps around bulging canvas bags. It's a long double-decker car, windowless and lit by gaslight. Will is reminded of a beehive. A small army of uniformed men sorts mail at narrow tables, flinging letters and oddly shaped bundles into open sacks. The entire left side of the carriage is floor-to-ceiling pigeonholes. Workers, each with a bag slung over his left shoulder, stand stand on tall ladders, sorting mail into the holes. The ladders run on rails and whiz to and fro with astonishing speed. "This is our postmaster, James Kilgore," the gangly porter says. A white-whiskered man in an official cap looks up from his clipboard. Will notices he only has a thumb and index finger on his right hand.
"Good evening to you,"
the postmaster says, and then,
"Oni! Where's that package for Edmonton?"
Startled, Will looks down to the floor as a scruffy brown and white mutt pushes a parcel toward Mr. Kilgore's feet. Then he sits back and looks immensely pleased with himself.
"Good boy,"
the postmaster says, tossing the bundle into an open sack and checking off something on his clipboard. He gives the dog a good scratch between his ears.
"This is Oni. He's our male dog."
Oni's brown triangular ears perk up, and his tail thumps appreciatively. From his collar hangs so many tags that Will is amazed the dog can raise his head. Will almost asks what they're all for, but stops himself just in time. Mr. Kilgore seems to sense his question.
"People give these to him wherever we stop. He's been all over. Houston, Churchill, Ann Arbor, the mayors, they present him with the tags. He's a good luck charm, our Oni. Gets the mail through on time, and we've never had a wreck the 15 years the mutt's been with us."
"He's a charming little fellow," Marin says, bending to give him a pat.
Will pats him too, mostly to have the chance to bump his hand against Marin's.
"Delightful," says Mr. Dorian, unmoved. "Shall we head on?"
"Give us a moment," says the postmaster. "Mail drop coming, and it gets a bit crowded up ahead." He checks his pocket watch. "Harrison, Reed, let's open her up."
Two men rush over and pull a chain to raise a tall metal panel in the carriage's side. Night air gallops in. In the darkness, Will can see telegraph posts flashing past.
"Bag on!"
shouts the postmaster over the clatter of the track. Rising like a mast from the center of the car is a sturdy metal pole. Two arms jut from it, one 3 feet above the other. Harrison and Reed hook a mailbag onto the lower arm and then swivel both arms so they're sticking straight out through the big window.
"Here we come!"
shouts one of the men, poking his head out.
"Get your head back in, you damn fool!" says Kilgore. "How many times have I told you? You want it taken off?"
The postmaster rolls his eyes at Will. There's a blur past the window, and a tremendous clattering noise, and Will sees the bag on the lower arm disappear, and at the same moment, the upper arm, empty seconds ago, swings inside with a hefty canvas bag.
"See that?"
says Kilgore with a proud shake of his head, even though he must have seen this 1,000 times.
"Their arm just swipes our bag of mail, and we swipe theirs. All right, lads, let's get sorting. We've got an hour before our next drop, and then we're into the muskeg."
"Bye, Oni,"
Marin says to the dog as they leave. The mutt wags his tail and then starts snuffling around various bundles on the floor as though he can read their addresses. The porter leads them through to the next car. Once the door closes behind them, Will notices how much quieter it is than colonist class. There must be more insulation, and better suspension, too, because the ride doesn't feel so rough. The floor is freshly painted white, and there are decorative swirls around the ceiling. Gas lamps are set at intervals along the wall. There's a stove at either end of the car, but no cooking smells or soot. Right now the carriage is being put to bed. Stewards are handing out pillows and blankets and lowering the sleeping berths. Heavy curtains hang in between for privacy. It is crowded, but much less so than colonist class. People are looking at them, and Will is aware how he, Marin, and Mr. Dorian stand out amongst the weathered cattle hands and farmers in undershirts and denim trousers. After several more cars, the porter leads them past storage compartments and crew quarters, and finally opens the door of a tiny cabin. He stands back to let them inside. There are 3 bunks against one wall, mostly obscuring the single window. Against the opposite wall, there's a narrow bench. Scarcely room to change your mind. That's what Will's mother used to say of their old apartment.
"There's shelves on the facing wall for your things," the porter says. "I hope this is adequate. It's the only free cabin in third class."
"We're extremely grateful," Mr. Dorian says. "Thank you."
I had one of the porters prepare your beds, and there's a washroom just at the end of the car. Dining car is a few beyond that. Will you be wanting a meal tonight?
We've already eaten, thank you, says Marin.
Past the dining cars, you'll find the saloon where you'll be performing tomorrow at midday, says the porter. It's a goodly space.
Excellent, Mr. Dorian says, closing the door. Good night. Will stows his small suitcase on a shelf and perches on the bench. His knees almost touch the lower bunk.
You were rash in the colonist cars, Mr. Dorian tells him quietly. You revealed more than you should have.
Will wondered if he'd be reprimanded.
I'm sorry, but it was terrible what Peters was doing. Why doesn't Sam Steele put a stop to it?
The Mounties don't patrol the colonist cars, Mr. Dorian says. They're left to sort out their own affairs.
I'll talk to my father about it, says Will. They're too crammed back there. Cattle are treated better.
I agree with Will, Marin says. It's not fair.
Many things aren't fair,
says Mr. Dorian placidly. But for the first time, Will realizes there's anger beneath this unnerving calm of his.
My father's people came from France to claim this land. Then the English came and took it from the French. Later, the Americans tried to take it from the English. As a Métis, I've seen my people shunted and shamed. I'm not numb to the hardship of these new colonists, but they are, after all, just another group of Europeans come to take land that once belonged only to the natives.
Will hasn't thought of this, and doesn't know how to reply. It's all more complicated than he can fathom.
Nonetheless, the ringmaster says, it was a very kind thing that you did for that boy, and your performance was excellent.
It was?
Will says, surprised by this praise.
One of the best debuts I've witnessed.
I was terrified.
It didn't show. And those drawings you did were remarkable.
Such energy.
Will didn't even get a chance to see them properly. They were whisked away so fast. He blushes. He can't remember his father ever complimenting him like this.
You'll give him a swelled head, Marin says.
I think he's got a very steady head on his shoulders. Now, William, why don't we visit the washrooms and allow Marin to change?
Will wonders how he's supposed to stay clean. He can't wash properly because of the face paint. Brushing his teeth is impossible since his toothbrush and paste are neatly laid out on the gleaming porcelain sink in his first-class stateroom. He supposes he can just use his finger and water. As Will removes his vest, the odd cloth spectacles he bought fall to the floor.
What are these?
Marin asks, picking them up.
Oh, he feels foolish. I got them in the junction.
Muskeg spectacles, says Mr. Dorian.
Will's hardly surprised the ringmaster knows about them. He seems to know about everything bizarre.
Is it true?
He asks.
About the hag?
Some people think so. I've never seen her myself, and I only started hearing stories once the train went through.
He nods reflectively.
It's like the rails cut a scar across the continent and released all sorts of things. But the explanation may be quite simple. Perhaps some people get hypnotized by the barren landscape and the moonlight. A kind of lunacy. And that's why they throw themselves into the bog.
All I can see is shadows of things, says Marin, trying on the spectacles.
That's the point, says Will. You're not supposed to look in her eyes.
Marin takes them off and slips them back into Will's vest.
Seems far-fetched to me.
We're passing through the muskeg tonight,
Will says uneasily, remembering the postmaster's comment.
We'll keep the curtains closed, says Mr. Dorian. Now, shall we go?
In the wash car, Will and Mr. Dorian wait their turn for the crowded sinks and toilets. A man with a hairy back sluices water under his arms and makes puddles on the floor. He glances suspiciously at Mr. Dorian and Will in the mirror. Will is aware how they stand out, an Indian fortune teller and a Métis gentleman in a suit. Afterward, they walk back to their compartment. Will sees the rear door of the carriage open, and Lieutenant Samuel Steele step inside. Will is overwhelmed by a strange mixture of emotions. Elation, for there's the Mountie in his scarlet uniform, looking as impregnable as a mountain fortress. But disappointment, too. Is his adventure over so soon? It seems too simple, too quick. All he has to do is call out and tell his story.
He'll be escorted back to first class. He'll see his father. Brogan and his men will be apprehended. He hesitates only a moment before stepping toward the Mountie. Mr. Dorian's hand closes firmly around his upper arm. The sensation is curiously familiar, and he realizes it's how Mackie held